Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor, where we transform my blog into an audio experience. I'm your host, MedPsych Moss, navigating healthcare as a patient and a future MD. Embark on a journey of vulnerability as we uncover the realities of trauma and developing resilience. Hit that follow and join us on this extraordinary life as a patient doctor. And now for the show.
Welcome, everyone. I am today interviewing Dr. Bisgrove, who is a board-certified family physician with a passion for health equity and how policy affects all we do in healthcare. She's deeply committed to improving the lives of the people she serves in Chicago. Through her work in health equity and education at Rush University Medical Center and nationally as a member of the American Medical Association, AMA, Council on Science and Public Health, and as an inaugural chair of the AMA's Disability Advisory Group. Previously, she has served in multiple leadership positions in both governments and advocacy, including with SSM Health Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Academy of Family Physicians, and the American Academy of Family Physicians, AAFP. She's currently pursuing a Master's of Public Health in Maternal and Child Care through the University of Minnesota School of Public Health in their online program, with an expected graduation date of spring 25. She's a proud member of the Docs with Disability community. Her disability is bilateral hearing loss, and she has had it since birth. Welcome, Dr. Bisgrove.
Thank you so much, student Dr. Moss, Stephanie.
Thank
you're
you.
You're almost there. Oh my God.
Almost there. Just four more months. I'm very excited.
Me too. I'm excited for you.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to thank you so much for being here today, Life as a Patient Doctor podcast. And I would love to ask you some questions first. Just tell me a little bit about your own background and journey into the medical field.
Well, interesting how it's all intertwined. I was born with a mild to moderate hearing loss, mainly in my left ear. And back when I was little, because I'm a lot older than you, but back when I was little, they didn't have newborn hearing screens. So it didn't occur to my parents that I might have a hearing loss until I was a little bit older. I would have colds, and my mom would realize I didn't turn around, I didn't respond, and also my speech would get worse. And so there was a point in time where I was sick with a cold, and my mother came up behind me and was banging pots and pans, and I didn't startle, I didn't turn around. And my mom's like, she's got a hearing loss. I think I was about one or two, I was somewhere between one and two at that point. And so my mom took me to an audiologist, and they said the issue was that they couldn't test until I was old enough to do the typical hearing test, which is when you're in the booth raising a hand when you hear the sounds, because as I said, technology back then, we didn't have the newborn hearing screens devices that many people in medicine are used to seeing and knowing about. So I was taught by using toys. If I heard a sound, I dropped a toy in a bucket. I think I got some kind of reward or good job. But once I did it consistently, they tested me, and yes, I had a hearing loss. So school modifications were made. My teachers were aware. I sat in the front of the classroom. And then when I was about eight, I came down with meningitis. And they, at the time, when I presented like a bacterial meningitis, instead of, although I ultimately had viral meningitis, for those who don't know, viral meningitis is milder. But my symptoms were severe enough that the doctors preemptively and just as a precaution put me on antibiotics until my tests came back. Not entirely clear, but we believe, because most people would say, well, viral meningitis doesn't cause hearing loss. Mm-hmm. And my hearing on one side was already on the border. Plus, it's possible I was given an antibiotic that is what's known as ototoxic, which is damaging to hearing. And what happened then was that my hearing loss got worse, although it wasn't discovered for a number of months. I took a standardized test that I usually take. And that year they switched the rules in terms of how you answer the test. And so since I didn't hear those directions, I just did everything the same way. And my scores went from being like the 99th percentile to the 50th percentile. My teachers thought that maybe there was some brain damage from the meningitis. But one of my teachers, Mrs. Gurney, said, well, why don't we try repeating the test to be sure? And she was standing in front of me and explaining the change in the rules. And I said to her, I didn't know that. And I still remember, I was still like 9 years old, but I still remember the look on her face, like a light bulb went off. No idea, but that what there was a light bulb, but I just remember the look on her face was very much, aha. I had no idea why. They had me retake all the tests, pull me out of class. My scores went back to what they were. And then the teachers brought the test and the evidence to my parents and said, her hearing is worse. So mom takes me back to the audiologist. We redo everything. And yep, now I need a hearing aid. I got my hearing aid. This is a fun one for Chicagoans. I am lifelong Chicagoans too. I got my hearing aid the day after the Bears won the Super Bowl in 1986. This is how old I am. Yes. So we went and got my hearing aid and then we went down, I think it was LaSalle Avenue in Chicago, but we went down the main street where they had the parade before the streets had closed and there's like banners and streamers everywhere. And my mom jokingly said, this is for your hearing aid. And I was like, yay. But so that was getting the hearing aid. And I just kind of went from there. I was always extremely lucky and had a lot of support, grammar school, middle school, high school. The American with Disabilities Act came about in 1990. Around the same time was the IDEAS Act, which is the Individualized Education Act, if I remember correctly. Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And IDEA, I didn't need much, but IDEA helped ensure that I had a path forward education. And I bring that up importantly because before IDEA, like the idea, pun intended, but that just the notion that kids with disabilities could be successful was like, no. Once IDEA came about and we had protection, it got easier. So I graduated from high school. IDEA came about in 1991. I graduated from high school in 1994 and then went to college. I was accepted at the Cornell University School of Engineering. Yes, an Ivy League school, which was great, but also like many like ivory tower institutions, especially at that point in time, very ableistic. Right. That was the first time I really had to fight for things I needed. Note taker in class, they had a note taking service, but I had to fight to be able to get it without having to pay for it. So that took some work and I used the ADA and I used IDEA. I mean, that was probably my first in college having to advocate for myself. That was probably the first time I really forayed into advocacy at all. Prior to that, my parents did it for me and I was learning and I'd have to like speak up in school and say, hey, I need this. But the teachers, everyone was always really with there and supportive. The first time I hit a barrier was college. At Cornell, and partly because it was so new. I mean, Cornell, my understanding, Cornell is much better about it these days, but the thing is, being the first is always a challenge. And in many ways, right, because of how old I was when laws were coming into play, many times I was the first. So I had to do that. And then I took a year off between college and med school because for various reasons, but also just to make sure my engineering grades were high enough for medical school. Yes, I did engineering. And engineering grades, they grade you down. And so to have that GPA, I just needed all of my grades. But also I applied multiple places. I applied lots of places. I only got interviews at two places. And I always wondered, I always thought maybe it's because of my hearing. Now I wonder, I always thought it was because of my engineering degree and my lower grades. Now I wonder if it's because of my hearing. Because there is something known, there are certain skills or functionality that different medical schools require. And some of them are very focused on what the student cannot do. Those are what are known as organic skills. There are other schools, Rush being one of them, I'm a graduate of Rush, that was very much about functional, not what you cannot do, but what you can do. And that really opens up the door for people with multiple abilities. So yes, me being a surgeon, granted, I can work with hearing, like assistive listening devices, and I did that in medical school, but that importance is just that barrier of that switch. I mean, medicine is probably one of all of the careers, medicine is the most ableistic. And ableism in society, as many people may know, is very much this, like, there's barriers, everything is really set up for people who can do everything. physically, psychologically, so on and so forth. And they don't think about how to make things work for people with different abilities. And making a society anti-ableistic requires us to think differently. There's what's called the medical model of disability. And this is interesting. The medical model of disability is, if you can't fix it, it's a problem. And it's the person's problem. And that leads, in my view, that leads to perfectionism among physicians with disabilities. That leads to barriers that we have to keep overcoming in society. If you start switching to a more ableism model of disability, then it becomes more apparent if you decrease the barriers in society, people with an impairment are much less disabled. So the impairment in a social model, which is anti-ableism, the impairment is the thing the person cannot do, and the disability is the barrier in society that prevents them from fully participating. Perfect example is going to be curb cuts, and we use this all the time in public health. Curb cuts allow wheelchairs to move up and down onto sidewalks, but they help everybody. Anyone with a stroller, anyone with a cart, anyone on a bike, curb cuts make life much easier. Now, in Evanston, where I live, there are lots of curb cuts that also have these bumps on them. That's for someone who's blind, so they know they're at the street. And we don't have to have any of this, but when we do, it makes things so much easier for everybody. And that's really the key of anti-ableism. It's not just about making things easier for people with disabilities. It's about making society and medicine, since that's my role, accommodating to all of us. So backtracking then to school, I got into Rush. I got into Rush and UIC, both places I was interviewed. And I came to Rush. Now at Rush, I ran into more barriers, mainly because people just didn't know. As far as we know, I was the first person with an accommodated disability in the medical college ever.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so you go through and you're like, we don't know what to do. We have to teach them. And so mm-hmm. that was where I started using. Now, the other thing with society is this interconnection between you have barriers, but then also sometimes you have privilege. And this is where I had to use my privilege to overcome the barriers. My father was on staff at Rush for over 40 years. At the point that I joined medical school, I think when I was in medical school, second or third year, he became chair of the Department of Radiology. He was someone everyone knew and everyone loved. And so when we started having my audiologist, who was also at Rush, Dr. Plod, when he and I started working toward getting the accommodations, both for having a note taker, having headsets in class. For us, we used to use that old big lecture hall. You guys do a totally different type of curriculum. Old lecture hall, totally different. Those old big lecture halls, I needed the headphones. And then we paid someone to take notes. One of my friends who took really good notes, they paid her because it was an accommodation for me. They as in the school. And so they were totally open to doing it. They just didn't know what to do. Then third year, it came time to really get into the, surgery rotation. We got headsets. I kind of became a guinea pig for my audiologist students, which I was fine with because they were doing all sorts of tests in the operating room as far as how everything works. But the lead surgeon would wear a microphone and I would wear headphones. And we got over the barrier because it was never about, well, we got to help this kid with a hearing loss. It was about, oh, we're just helping David Turner's daughter. So it was like, how do you get over barriers? Sometimes you have to use whatever you got. So that was a big thing, is using that. And I didn't even realize how important it was until I graduated. Because then I was in residency, I was on my own, and lots of stories there, but I had to do a lot of fighting. I was frequently marginalized. I will tell you to this day, I hate patient satisfaction scores, even though I'm doing much better with them. Originally, before my old job in Wisconsin, before it really connected that sometimes the patient satisfaction scores were down because a patient would say something to me and I wasn't hearing them because I was looking at the computer, they thought I was ignoring them. And so it was very strange having majority of these satisfaction scores being great wonderful listener, so attentive, and then this total opposite. And I was like, what's going on? Finally figured out with my hearing, bought for a scribe, which they gave to me, and suddenly my scores went up. But it took a long time to just kind of overcome that. And then I had to fight my old organization when the pandemic came because I needed clear masks and they didn't want to get them. So anyone with a hearing loss will know and nod knowingly that during the pandemic, not having access, not having someone you're talking to have access to a mask with a clear window, you can't hear what's going on. You can't tell what's going on. Your ability to lip read is taken away. And so that was a huge fight. My scribe would frequently have to tell, my in-person scribe would frequently have to tell patients, you know, she didn't hear you, because she could tell. And the patients sometimes were so soft that I didn't even know they were talking. So it was.
And those masks just really, it's so hard, even just people who do not have that barrier. It was so hard to, people had to learn how to talk different, speak louder. And then also, there's.
Oh, yes. So my patients coming to Rush, it was never an issue. Because again, Rush now has this massive program for helping students with disabilities. Rush has a different culture. Rush has always been open. I've always been open, always been willing to learn. And I've always appreciated that. Like I said, when I went through as a medical student, they just didn't know yet. So now Rush knows. And so I said, I need clear masks. They said, well, we have these types. And said, you know what? These types are too big and bulky for the patients to wear. They don't like them. How about these masks? And they went, oh, these are better, and got them and switched.
That's awesome.
So you eat the ones you saw in the office with the windows. So.
Right. Yeah. We use those also in the hospital sometimes. Yeah. There were definitely, we use them the most in patient psych wards, whereas actually where I saw them the most. I didn't really see them throughout the hospital anywhere else, but they were always available for the inpatient psych wards.
I think as someone in psychiatry reached out to me. So the ones you saw, the big bulky ones were the only ones there before I returned to Rush 2 years ago. When came back and I asked for the others, it was like light bulb, bright idea. And so they had them more. And as more people found out about them, that was the more you would see the ones, the clear masks that do better at covering the patient's face from a protection standpoint that then have the clear window. As opposed to the big bulky ones that just left massive gaps. So they did not have the other ones before I came back. So it's just a matter of people knowing about them.
Educating.
I've even brought up to Omar and Paul, Omar Latif and Paul Casey, our CEO and CMO, that you know, when you do videos, if people are wearing masks, put the clear masks on them with the window masks so that people know that Rush, A, we have them, and B, Rush is very accommodating. So
that's a good point. Yeah.
Omar thinks it's a great idea.
So. Yeah. No, that is huge. And how much it speaks to people sometimes really want to help. They just don't know how. They don't, without you being able to provide what works with you and your own knowledge and your own background, people are more willing to help. They need that education. And a lot of times they do want to learn.
Yes. And the lack of knowledge is part of the barrier, which is why it's like, to me, shifting the culture is so important.
Right.
Because when you shift the culture to one where the baseline is, oh, let's be creative and how we can help people, because it's not that hard. That's easier than having to constantly educate people all the different ways you can help. That's why I've started really honing in on how do we shift the culture, which will take longer, but much longer. But I think if we can make headway, it helps, it builds on itself just because it makes sense.
Yeah, and it's everlasting. It's more lasting. Even when people come and go, a culture will stay. It will be. I love that.
Okay.
So then, what happened after residency?
There was residency, and then I was in Wisconsin. And then, like I said, I had the challenges in Wisconsin. I had some in residency as well. I had we have our behavioral psychologist who's supposed to help us learn how to work with patients. My behavioral psychologist wanted to analyze my language pragmatics. So I'm like, I'm not a lab rat, please. I didn't know how to say that because I'm a resident, they're the attending. But yeah, he was so focused on by language pragmatics, this medical model of, oh, this is interesting, as opposed to the social model of disability of, oh, I'm really like, I should not be asking this. So
right.
Yeah. I did not like feeling like a lab rat in residency.
Yeah. No one deserves that. Now, were you disclosing every single time, like when you applied to residency, applied to job, was that just part of like right away, like on your application, or did you wait until you actually were sitting down with someone to have a conversation with them?
I disclosed. It was in my essay. We always thought in my family, we always thought that was my edge, especially from medical school. We had no idea that it was at that time it was a barrier. That we thought that was my edge. No, it was for college and medical school. The central part of my essay was learning how to be a survivor, a thriver, and an advocate with a hearing loss.
Amazing.
So, yeah, less so with college, but with the college application, but medical school, definitely. How it made me better at understanding patients. But yeah, it was always front and center.
I'm really glad you say that, because that is, I know, like for myself and a lot of other individuals who have maybe more invisible disabilities, or just we didn't know whether to disclose or where it was most appropriate to disclose, even though we very much know how much it is going to be a positive and a strength to our own story and to our interactions with patients. It's hard to be able to, it's scary to know what will be the results. Yeah.
Right. And it's important for people to hear that. I mean, we walked into it. My parents and I, and my aunt, who is a professor at DePaul and an English professor and in administration at DePaul, who looked at all of my essays, none of us ever thought. So, but going in with that ignorance was probably a good idea, because then it was like, this is who I am. This is where I need to go. I'm always kind of owning your truth and your story. As scary as it can be sometimes, you may not get in all the places, but you'll get in the place where you belong, especially when it comes to having a disability. Because if I had ended up at, say, U of C or Harvard, U of C wrote like a really nasty letter saying maybe I shouldn't go into medicine. Like, they did not have to do that after. They didn't offer me a secondary. They literally sent me a letter. And my father went to U of C medical school. So you can imagine the letter he wrote back. It was ridiculous. Like, he was so pissed. He's like, what? It's like, maybe you should consider another career. And again, we thought it was because of the engineering. And we didn't think about the hearing at all. But he was so angry. And he's like, see if I ever donate to you again. And then suddenly he got a really, really like, oh my God, we're so sorry letter.
Uh-oh, we made a mistake.
Like, I am in a love and you did this to my daughter. What the?
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yes. Had I ended up there with that attitude, it probably would have been far worse. So.
Right. You landed in a place where you're supposed to be and you're authentic and to yourself, which I love.
And that's important really for anybody, because if we're not hiding, if we are trying to hide who we really are and what we really need, it's only going to cause trouble. Because then for anyone, you need to be in a place that responds to you, whether it's school, work, colleges, med school, residency, you need to be in a place that responds to you, responds to you well. And so being authentic, it's never a sure thing, but being authentic to who you are and what you need is important. The other thing that's important is doing your research. I mean, all schools, there's studies that have shown all schools are supposed to have these more functional technical standards. That's what they're called. They're supposed to have these like functional technical standards, which is the focus on what you can do as opposed to what's known as the organic or unfixable, unchangeable technical standards. And so really, and they're supposed to display it on their website. But in 2016, there was a study done led by a physician by the name of Phil Zazov, who also deaf, was one of the very first people with any kind of deafness to go to medical school. And he's recently retired, but he wrote a study. And he had the kind of the same attitude going to med school, where it was people going, you can't be a doctor. He's like, why not? So he was just like, well, what do you mean? And he did it anyway. But he had to find a place that would take him. But they did a study about the technical versus organic, or the technical standards or organic versus functional, and whether schools were good at saying that, yes, this is what we do. And they were, like 30% of schools, medical schools had functional standards that were listed. Majority had nothing. And so you have to do your research, and we have to advocate for schools to get better. But as an individual, do your research for sure, for medical school, for residency, so that, all right, this is a place where I can be my authentic self. And that's true for actually anything, any marginalized identity, anything. If the school is loud and proud about who they are and that jives with you, that's a good place to apply to.
That's such a good point. I have that. I wrote that down, so I'll make sure I'll include that in the pod, in the show notes, and also on the blog post regarding this. That is really good to know. And I feel like that is a common thing of you have to look and see if you can actually see that they actually jive with. I love what you said. Jive with who you are inside and the same culture and same type of environment that you want to be in.
Right. And that's part of self-advocacy, is like, sometimes you have to put legwork in, but that initial legwork comes out so much better in the end if it helps you find a place that is going to help you grow. So, which is the whole point of becoming a physician, a nurse, a healthcare provider of any way, shape, or form. It's essential.
Right. That makes complete sense. Well, I think you started talking a little bit about how it will help you with patient care, but can you speak a little bit more on how that, going through your experience of self-advocacy, how has that impacted how you maybe educate your patients on how to be self-advocates themselves or other individuals?
A lot of times it's other individuals, but also it's because there's varying from the ableism and anti-ableism lens, there's varying levels of disability. So when I was still in Wisconsin, there was a point, I think I've been there, I'm trying to think how long I've been there. I think because I was at my clinic for 14 years total, and I think this was about year 4 or 5, that I suddenly, like, there was a group of people with disabilities that had a whole program that was like in the next town over. I was in Oregon, they were in Stoughton. Before people go, wait, you're in Oregon, Wisconsin, I will tell you our town to the south is Brooklyn. So yes, Wisconsin's got funny names. But there was a group in Stoughton, which was another town over, a huge program for people with multiple levels of disability, usually on the more severe side, but they lived in house. They lived in group housing. They had they lived in like houses. I went to the houses to work with them. They had houses as opposed to like assisted living facilities. And then the houses were in a complex that worked kind of like assisted living, but regular people lived there as well. And the houses were all accommodated. They had ramps for the wheelchairs. They had the grab bars. They had everything. And all these people had social workers, health aides, and it was all paid for by the state because Wisconsin actually has a really good program for that. But the thing they kept running into that was hard is finding physicians who understood what was going on. And so at one point, one of their leads for one particular patient reached out because his physician had retired. I didn't even know if he was retired, but they needed a new doctor. And they were reaching out to one of my colleagues. But my colleague was like, no, really who you want is Dr. Bisgrove. And so they brought him in to see me. And then I met her, the social worker. And it was like, this was a good fit. And over the course of the next several years, I got so many of them as patients. I had a whole community for patients who could see me at my job, because Wisconsin's insurance is a little bit different. It's more insular to a point. It's very much like a holistic wraparound care. But what that means is patients who have insurance who can be seen at SFM can only be seen at SFM. They cannot be seen, say, at the University of Wisconsin. Those who are seen at the University of Wisconsin frequently cannot be seen at SSM. The insurances separate that. It's very much, it's like a contained, they're both contained HMOs. Like you don't have the ability to cross over like people do in Illinois. So they had someone in the UW program who's someone I work with, but someone in UW who all the UW patients went to, and UW is University of Wisconsin because we were near Madison, but someone in UW, and then I was in SSM, and I just like got a whole collection of patients. And then their insurance has switched. And then he and I would say, hey, that we'd send notes or talk. And it was just made it easier. So But
I
yeah,
love
it was
that.
the, yeah, but the community. And so a lot of it was working with this group of people. It was really helping them with establishing their own identity and their own advocacy and just being that doctor that got it. SSM was very much about like do the work, productivity. It was like hard work. I didn't do as much education then. I was getting into advocacy slowly, but the journey toward advocacy within ableism has really only come more to fruition more recently. So coming back to Illinois and coming back to Rush. But
Wow.
yeah, but it was important. So, but yeah, and coming back here, I'm starting to do more education and teaching in terms of how to get physicians working better with patients with disabilities. And we have a lot of work to do. There was a study done in 21 that they did a survey of over 700 physicians. 85% of them said that patients with significant disabilities have a far worse quality of life than patients who don't. So, and it, you know, I don't, my quality of life is personal perspective. And you can make someone's quality of life really good if you listen to them and work with them and what they need. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're disabled or not. So.
Right, a lot of it's almost it sounds like it's created by the system itself.
Oh yes. Yes. Quarter of our adult population has a disability. And so it's like we have to do this.
Right, exactly. I know that you mentioned a little bit about you having an also a unique perspective by being a mother and with children with disabilities. Can you speak a little bit
Yes.
about being how being a mother as a doctor, and how that has influenced how you work with your own children.
Again, there's a big advocacy piece because, again, it's the system. My younger one, my 13-year-old, was not di has autism. She was, but up until, and this is where misogyny also comes in. Up until the last 5, 6 years or so, it was like that the thinking was only boys have autism. Girls don't get autism. And it's fascinating now the number of women patients I'm getting that have autism that were just they were just recently diagnosed because of the shift in thinking.
Interesting.
But Maya was frequently misdiagnosed. And then she wasn't properly diagnosed with autism until after we came to Illinois. And there was a neuropsychologist. Interestingly, they used to work at the same place I did in Wisconsin, but she had background and training in how autism looks in girls, because people who know autism is a spectrum. And boys on the boys' end of the spectrum frequently looks different than girls' end of the spectrum. And it's not always. I mean, sometimes girls can look more like the typical boys and boys can look more like the typical girl, but because that opening up of girls can have autism, suddenly now it's like, yep, got diagnosed and we're finally getting support. But it has taken a ton of work to really push that through in terms of working with the schools. And in Wisconsin, because she wasn't diagnosed properly, it was a disaster. She was doing okay, but the symptoms were getting worse. And then we had the pandemic, which was totally through her. And then we get here, and then she has to start a new school. And one of her big things is that transitioning and adjusting to a new environment is ridiculously hard for her. And so, familiarity, structure, we had to learn all these things. And being a mother of a child with a disability was part of the equation. But being a physician, when I was in Wisconsin, I was medical advisor of a school district, of the kids' school district, because I have a 16-year-old now as well. I was medical advisor of their school district, and that's required by Wisconsin law. Each district have a medical advisor. So I was that for 8 years. My husband's also a teacher and had a lot of kids with special needs in his classroom. So the two of us understand how the system works and doesn't work. And I think if it wasn't for the both of us, and I say this a lot, if it wasn't for the both of us, I think my younger one, would have a much harder time and probably not being doing well at all. And we've really had to fight. There's been kids bullying her. It's been a mess. But we've really had to fight to keep her safe and secure and able to learn. And there's so many barriers we've had to push through. And I'm always thinking, for God's sakes, like my kid has probably the best combination of parents you could possibly have to help push through this with our backgrounds and our knowledge. What about the kids who don't have that? So few kids do. So few
Right.
kids have parents who have the knowledge, the wherewithal, the time. I mean, my husband works part-time now, and so he really can focus in and fight this. I weigh in whatever I can, and we talk, but because he has the time, like, how many parents have that? Really not.
No, not
Very
at all.
few.
Especially with jobs, like you said, there's so much, and just the knowledge of understanding, like the school system, those IEPs, 504s, and then I'm sure it was even a different situation in Illinois education versus Wisconsin, wasn't
Absolutely.
it?
No, yes. It's hard. I mean, yeah, and it's just, I keep thinking, it's like, and the problem is the system. It really is the system. Like, now that we have a little sort of insular setup for her, she's doing really well. I mean, her main IEP coordinator and teacher at her school just emailed us yesterday. She had the best day in science ever. She was on target. She was just nailing everything. She's been doing really well. She's getting better at being more social, saying hi to kids. I mean, really important skills, but it's taken us a lot of work to get to this point.
I
So,
think
2 years.
that is also a good thing, is like these things don't happen overnight. Even for someone with the resources, with the knowledge, with all these things, accommodations, just all this takes time. And I think that sounds like it's the biggest thing, to like not give up hope.
Right. And keep fighting, quite honestly. So keep fighting, keep going, keep looking. I mean, it's the wall. Like when there's a wall, I'm always looking. How do you get, like, it's bashing into the wall multiple times, you're not going to get anywhere. So I'm always looking. How do I get over the wall, under the wall, around the wall? I mean, that's kind of the thought process, both for me and for my kids. Now, my older one is doing really well, but has developed, like a lot of adolescents, has developed anxiety. So tons and tons of, there is a mental health crisis for kids, for teenagers, children, adolescents, massive mental health crisis. And my older one, it's been hard too, because so much energy and focus goes into caring up for the younger one, that to shift back the older one and remember, hey, they need help too, it's a challenge. And so that shifting, that balancing, and just the importance of teamwork. A lot of marriages can be broken by this, and that constant communication and teamwork and just understanding that, and hope, is really important in order to keep your marriage together as well.
Right. Yeah, it def I can imagine it's impacting the sibling dynamic, and then, like you said, the marriage dynamic. There's so many additional efforts and time that need to be placed, and it's
Yeah,
hard to balance. How do
very much so.
you practice balancing between the two children, making sure, since they both have such unique needs?
We're not always perfect. I think a lot of our balance, first and foremost, like, I don't know if we're ever perfect. We do our best, and we give ourselves grace, and we frequently split duties, and sometimes that things get dropped because of it, because our duties are split. My husband does more of the teacher part, I do more of the medical part, but also he is, because the younger one has a lot more of a medical need, I am the primary one, the primary advocate and worker for the younger one. The older one does really well academically, once they're focused, but they can have challenges, but my husband works more with them. And so it just becomes important to be able to just understand the dynamic and the dynamic. It's never fixed. Roles and needs will change. We're frequently going, my husband and I are frequently going back and forth, who needs what, and then we'll argue. When something gets dropped, we get mad at each other, and then we fight. Then we let it settle down, and then we're like, okay, how do we fix this? I mean, it's just like, yeah, there's always that, why didn't you do this? What do you mean, why did I do this? Why didn't you do this? And so getting through that, again, just sort of knowing we can get through this, that this isn't an end, is important. I mean, an important part of marriage, but particularly when you've got kids with special needs.
I appreciate that very much, and especially with my own marriage, just the commitment is so important, and knowledge that, like you said, that not everyone's perfect, life won't be perfect. It's always about just knowing that things will get better. You just have to keep working at it. I
Right.
love
Things will, I think a better way to put it, things will ebb and flow. They'll get better, they'll get
yes.
worse. And also that maintaining that compatibility with your partner is important. I mean, that takes a lot of work too. Granted, like a lot of people, sometimes they evolve in ways in their marriage where they can't keep it compatible. And that's important to recognize as well. But
yes,
it's marriage is work. Having children is extra work. And then having children who have extra needs is extra work. And so you have to, both of you have to be committed to that. And also give yourself and the other person, particularly the other person, grace, because I think we forget that a lot.
Right. Oh, I love that. Well, thank you, Dr. Bisgrove. You've touched on so many amazing things of talking about, from your own education to your own journey as an advocate, as a physician, and then also talking about how that then you use that with your own patients and then now with your own children. Is there any final tips that you would like to give our audience, especially any ones that are current medical professionals or ones that are in the works that maybe even have disabilities themselves? Any last guidance or notes?
I've said this before. This isn't the first podcast I've done about this, but I've said this before, and it's true. It's really important to own your story. It's really important to own your story, own your truth, going, this is who I am, and this is what I need. Because in this day and age, until we can change the culture, the only way we can affect change is by speaking out or collecting a group of allies to help you speak out. They always talk about it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to do everything. So if you cannot express in the way our society works, if you cannot express what your needs are, you will 100% be run over. And so owning your story and going, this is who I am, this is what I need, and I will be the most awesome person, healthcare professional, advocate you've ever had if you give me what I need. And like just owning that, that's really important. Because yeah, people are always kind of in it for, well, what's in it for me? It's like, well, you give me this, I will give you like the most awesome, I will give you awesomeness, because we all have our own awesome. We all have our perspectives and our ability to bring things to the table. And owning that is important, really important.
Yes, I love that. And that kind of goes for anyone in the medical professional and in just society, to own your story and own your truth. And that's where you can find other community members and other groups where you can be yourself. And I love that. So thank you, Dr. Bisgrove, so much.
Absolutely.
Very much appreciate you taking the time to speak with me and speak to my growing audience. So thank you so much. And I look forward to continuing to see you as my own mentor and as a future physician myself.
Absolutely. And I look forward to knowing your next steps. This is exciting.
Thank you.
If you know any other individual who might benefit from any of these episodes, please hit share to at least one individual that can help. That's how we share the word. That's how we overcome bias and break down barriers together. So thank you so much. You can listen at anywhere you listen to your podcasts. You can follow me on social media, MedPsychMoss. You can look at my website for more resources on things that I found successful, both as a patient and as a future doctor. And I hope to see you next episode. Take care, everyone.